Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast that's going to be a little bit squeakier than usual. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanagieser, fresh off a 12-year stint in Folsom County Prison.
Yes, but that's not why, I'm going to go down that road. As far as my reference at the top of the episode here.
You mean 15 seconds ago?
Yeah, my usual podcasting chair has died, it seems. I went to unfold it, and it decided just to snap. So I'm now using good old reliable Rolly here. And
Dave, I'm so sorry. Are you okay?
I am okay. The chair, not so much. But this chair that I'm currently in is very comfortable. It just tends to make noise when I turn it, or roll it, or basically do anything in it. So I'm going to do my best, folks, to not cause this thing to make any noise.
Well,
that said, if you hear reports online afterwards of me laid up with a very stiff back and uncontrollable muscle spasms, there may be reasons.
I'm already trying to get a couple articles circulating about Venture Podcast Enterprise and the haunted chair. I also discovered that listening back to the audio of some of the last episodes, I think, let's play our give the listeners a peek behind the curtain. David and I record this over Skype, using far from state-of-the-art equipment for a budget of $0. I recently realized that probably because I have my headphones boosted so loud, there's a bit of a tinny echo in previous ones. So I may actually stop paying attention because I have you quieter, but hopefully it won't sound like David has a robot chorus behind him. So, squeaky chair, less reverb. I think it'll balance out to normal.
I hate to tell you, Andrew, I actually do have a robot chorus behind me at all times.
Why do you keep it a secret this long?
I don't want to make people feel awkward.
I would have been so happy for you.
I could have overseen
their, like, welcome to the family ceremony, or whatever you do with a robot chorus.
They're mostly murderous. I've noticed this. That's kind of the other reason I keep them on the down low.
Oh, wow.
I mean, they're sentient beings.
So that's why you got a story inspiration credit on Puppet Master.
Other things I don't like to talk about out loud.
Dave Babbitt, truly a man of letters.
Indeed. But we digress, folks. And there might be some reasons for why we're digressing.
Those reasons be?
All right, so last time we followed the editor of Deep Red to the movie we're talking about this week, Machine Gun McCain, a 1969 crime thriller starring John Cassavetes and Peter Falk and Britt Eklund.
Don't forget Gina Rowlands.
And Gina Rowlands. Well, we'll get to her eventually, i.e. the highlight of this movie. But, this is, it's a film where we rolled the dice, neither one of us had seen it, and by roll the dice, I mean I rolled the dice.
The listener, generally we try not to plan things out too far in advance because half the fun of doing it is David and I surprising each other. So some of the films that we've looked at, both of us had seen recently. Sometimes it's been a film that we haven't seen for a decade, and sometimes it's a film that one of us has, one of us hasn't. This was a case where not only have neither of us seen Machine Gun McCain previously, neither of us had, like, really any understanding of what it was about beyond the trailer. But the moment that Dave sent it, and I'm like, John Cassavetes and Peter Falk, yeah, I'm convinced.
Yeah, and it's one of the, it's ostensibly this film is apparently a bit of a cult movie. It's been released on Blu-ray by Blue Underground, apparently, who have specialized in releasing a bunch of, you know, sort of cult Italian films, including the works of Dario Argento, amongst others.
They're the criterion for the working man.
Yeah, sort of along those lines. And the end result is a film that, not to bury the lead here, so we'll just get it right out in front of us here.
It certainly is a film.
Yeah, it's not the worst thing we've watched on this show, but not the best by any stretch of the imagination there, and the amount of a reaction it provokes is kind of non-existent.
It's pretty good without being interesting, and it's strange without being bonkers.
Yeah, I mean, there's trust me, we still have plenty to say. This is why we do notes in advance, but it is, yeah, this is probably one of those films where it's a cult movie by virtue of its cast and how relatively obscure it is. Not because it necessarily has earned a rabid reputation or fan base for any particular reason. So, yeah, anybody hoping that we're talking about a lost gem this week, not quite the case, but...
I have a feeling that the second you post this, James is going to hop on Twitter and argue with us talking about how dare you sully the good name of Machine Gun McCain.
It's a distinct possibility. Personally, I kind of wish they'd stuck with the name of the book it's based off of, Candyleg.
Candyleg! It's got so much personality.
It's got so much personality, and apparently this film is, again, from what minimal I can find, is only loosely based on this book. So I'm choosing to believe that it's a novel about loan sharks in the game Candyland. So that's my take on it.
So if you're listening, Hollywood or Hollywood North, come and get some ideas from us. We'd like to make money. So yeah, I guess speaking of loan sharks, I guess that sort of. How are we? David, it was your pick, so you take all the blame and responsibility that comes with contextualizing this. So for the uninitiated. What do we look at Machine Gun McCain to glean a greater knowledge of? What's the meta for this week?
Okay, I mean, if we're going to be looking at this film and trying to extrapolate some sort of larger sense of cinema culture, as it were, I mean, it really can only be looked at as sort of a genre picture. It's a crime gangster movie about organized crime, and it's probably interesting, I would say, in two regards that are worth considering. One is the fact that this is a film that is about American mobsters, set in America, particularly Las Vegas, which we've once again returned to for a surprising amount.
All roads lead back to Vegas.
What this says about our subconscious and what it's trying to tell us, who can say? But it's featuring American movie, well, let's put movie stars maybe in quotes. I mean, I would say at least one of these people definitely counts as a star. And other two are really highly respected, high caliber actors, but I don't know the degree to which, you know, John Cassavetes, you know, really constitutes a star.
He is a star within certain circles. And I have a feeling this won't be the last we see him, but John Cassavetes is one of those guys where, you know, it seems half of his fans know him as an actor. He's appeared in, what was it, Brian De Palma's The Fury, Roman Polanski's Rosemary's Baby, Robert Aldrich's The Dirty Dozen. But he also, for the other half of the audience, they know him as a writer and director. And he's pretty prominent within the sort of burgeoning American independent film scene from the 1950s onward. The film Shadows in particular is really ahead of its time in terms of its social focus. And, I mean, there are plenty of famous stories where as his career went on and he would take sort of the actor for higher roles, I think he has the famous quote where he says, "Directing and writing is what I like to do best. Making movies is my hobby, but it's also a very expensive hobby, and that's why I have to be an actor."
Yeah. Which, yeah, I mean, certainly he's in good company. I mean, plenty have taken that sort of approach there, or at least done sort of work-for-hire material so they could go off and do their own stuff, such as writer-director John Sayles, who spent, you know, wrote a lot of exploitation fare, including Piranha, in part to help finance his sort of independent productions and what are considered sort of his great works, as it were.
Yeah, so the next time you slag Piranha, remember, without that, we wouldn't have Return of the Sea Caucus 7.
There we go. So John Cassavetes may be a star, but it's, you know, this very American, you know, genre and very American setting. And yet the entire movie, it's an Italian production. This is not a U.S. co-financed movie. This is a straight-up Italian film starring that which cast American actors. to lend it some box office clout and presumably to sell it across the world. And this is hardly the only film to do this that came out of Italy. I mean, most famously, there is Sergio Leone's Dollars trilogy starring Clint Eastwood, which picked him up and, you know, sort of, you know, hey, we got an American actor in here. You know, maybe this will open up a few extra doorways in order to sell it across the world. And it worked. Likewise, Mario Bava's Planet of the Vampires was an international co-production, but certainly, again, part and parcel was to get actors from around the world in order to make the film more marketable across
our film wonderful little globe. Film is an industrial here. Art at the end of the day, and, you know, it's all well and good if you want to make beautiful think pieces, but unless you're actually getting a return on your investors' money, I mean, you're not going to be able to make a lot of them.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, so this comes out in 1969, correct?
It comes out in 1969. Now, from what I can tell, and again, it's hard to confirm the exact dates of release. This film was apparently released in Italy in 1969, but I don't think it saw release stateside until 1970. Which, either way, this still puts it right squarely within the time where Peter Falk is becoming a major star via Columbo. On television.
I was going to say, listing off stars of the film, you didn't mention Falk, and I was waiting to drop out just one more thing.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, I would just like to know for the record, we never discussed this as a rule. I am perfectly fine with allowing Columbo episodes to constitute as films.
Really? So why didn't you say that before? Oh, because I was thinking that too. I love Columbo. I think that was the moment when I realized, oh, hey, I actually am turning into an old man. But yeah, so I guess it's interesting that you bring up Leone, because with the quote-unquote spaghetti westerns, we see Italian films being marketed for an international audience using American stars, but there's also a different sensibility being applied to a classic genre. And what's interesting is that in 1968, Arthur Penn makes a little film called Bonnie and Clyde. And we've talked about the Hollywood Renaissance before, but a lot of film scholars and film historians, they generally look to Bonnie and Clyde as sort of the beginning of the new American cinema. And because with that, it takes a more European sort of the, as much as I hate to use the term, an art house approach to a very familiar form. And so hearing about this film and being like, well, knowing that you have Cassavetes, who's known as an independent and rather challenging filmmaker in his own right, you have an Italian production working in American genre territory, and it's coming out, you know, a stone's throw away from Bonnie and Clyde, surely this film is going to occupy the same territory. And I don't know if it actually does, though.
Well, it's probably good to get into the plot of the film here. So once again, people, we spoil the hell out of movies on this podcast. So if anything we've said has actually indicated to you that you want to see this movie and keep all its quote-unquote surprises in away until you actually get to see it, maybe stop now. But I think that's for pretty much everybody who cares.
Before we dive into the film itself, though, I think the other thing that might be useful to bring up is also, like, 1968 is not just when there's a different formal consideration towards the gangster film, but we also have a very different representation and, like, sort of characterization of criminals on screen. Because anybody who's seen, like, old 1930s, you know, gangster films and that, it's, you know, I remember, like, Lawrence Tierney and Dillinger and things like that, where a lot of early crime films are presented as sort of cautionary fables. And even Cagney, it's like, well, he meets his fate in the end, right? And then, you know, you sort of, through the ages, like, okay, well, you get more with the noir influence. There's more of that deep dive into the underbelly. It's not just white hats versus black hats. And then by the time you get to someone like, say, Scorsese, it's like, okay, well, not only are we reveling in criminals, but we're showing how they're cooler and have a better life and more stuff than you ever will. And so, like, the 1960s, 1970s, that's kind of this turning point where kind of like the filmic idea of the anti-hero really starts emerging in American crime films. I mean, surely there are earlier and later examples, but this film kind of comes out in that same time. And I only bring that up, though, because our hero is a criminal, and the villains are all criminals as well, and it causes this weird play of... There's some weird interplay between ideas of, like, justice and containment and retribution and what is actually being celebrated here. So it's not cops versus robbers, it's robbers versus worse robbers, I guess.
Well, I would say that, you know, this is part and parcel, again, you're not wrong in terms of the trend we sort of see, because films other also that precede this, other things like Point Blank, where these are films set squarely within the criminal underworld, to the point where there are no signs of, you know, righteous authority or justice anywhere. I mean, you're ultimately operating in such a completely different headspace that you kind of, it ceases to be a matter of, as you say, white hats and black hats, and more just a simple case, but more about, you know, the degrees of morality that exist amongst these individuals, or, you know, chucking morality right out the door, you know, the psychology of these characters and what, you know, we sort of take away from them. And that kind of poses some interesting questions. Because, again, in the case of something like Bonnie and Clyde, to come back to that film from 68, you have a film there that, yeah, ostensibly they're the heroes of that movie, but they're also unrepentant murderers. And yet the film is also asking us to feel, you know, that there's a tragedy in the final fate that they have at the end of that film, which, I don't think corresponds to, you know, the real-life versions of the Bonnie and Clyde, but certainly the film definitely wants us to sort of look at there as being something, if not noble, at least sympathetic to them. And
yeah, with Arthur Penn, I feel like, yeah, because the film at one and the same time, it valorizes the characters, and maybe just because they got really attractive people to play them. But in the course of its telling, though, the film also sort of lampoons them as being, like, you know, they're non-functional individuals. You know, even the poem they write is, like, straight up doggerel in that, and they don't recognize the difference. So I think maybe it's the move towards a more complex characterization that, you know, gangsters are no longer just, you know, they're a gangster in one dimension that fulfills a narrative role, but that we're starting to think of them as characters and people as well. That can be many things, even a number of completely contradictory things all at the same time.
And credit where credit's due to Machine Gun McCain, because there is, I think, an effort to try and do that. Emphasis on try. But, I mean, you can see where it's trying to pick up the ball and sort of run with it in terms of, you know, let's, you know, take a look at these characters and their relationships and their inner psychology. And there is some interesting groundwork laid throughout this movie where, in much better filmmakers' hands, I could see this kind of working. But I guess that does sort of bring us back to, well, what is this film actually about other than, broadly speaking, gangsters. The short version of the plot of this movie is Peter Falk plays one of the higher ups in the West Coast, West Coast Division. Yeah, Charlie.
Because otherwise, I'm just going to call him Columbo for the whole episode.
Yeah. Charlie Adamo, the head of, or sort of higher up, who's running the West Coast mob operations, on behalf of basically what is the New York Syndicate. They've put him in charge. He's supposed to clean everything up. And he has this bright idea that he wants to muscle in on this Las Vegas casino, the Royal, in order to get himself a bigger piece of the action. Of course, this is kind of what he doesn't realize at first, is that he's basically planning to muscle in on the territory that his bosses already control. Something, you know, that's going to be kind of a problem here. But in the process, before he discovers that little fact out, he has made arrangements to knock over the Royal with a low-level and extremely young thug who convinces him to fund the money to help break out the one person they need to pull off this job.
And who is that one person?
That person is Hank McCain, played by John Cassavetes, who just so happens to be this young thug's father. So when we find McCain, he's being paroled, despite having a life sentence, thanks to a $25,000 bribe that has presumably gone to somebody we've never seen.
Yeah, turns out that's all it takes.
Yeah, and the film, at first, I was going to say, it looked like, you know, as it's starting, that this is going to be a case of, oh, they've busted out this guy to help with this job, but he's having trouble adjusting to the outside. And for, like, maybe 5 minutes, you get that sense that's where this movie's maybe going to go, as he has this awkward hugging reunion with his son just outside
the prison. It's like Sling Blade as a heist movie.
Yeah. Except as it very quickly turns out, yeah, the relationships are a little more simultaneously more complex and less complex at the same time. Because as we discover, basically McCain's son just really wants him out of prison to help them pull off this job. And despite their, you know, awkward hug at the prison itself, we very quickly come to discover McCain really doesn't care for his kid one iota. He doesn't even want to be referred to as his father.
Yeah, because even when he picks him up, there's that scene where, yeah, he calls him dad and he's like, ah, lay off with that. I've only seen you twice.
Yeah, exactly. And from this point, we pretty much follow McCain as he goes out, gets married to a woman who's like half his age, played by Irene, played by Britt Eklund. And from there, the film sort of ends up following, you know, Falk discovering the error that he's made and trying to call the deal off. Something that McCain is not quite down with, as he sort of proceeds headlong into pulling this job off, regardless of who gets in his way. And, you know, that includes people such as his kid.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts, especially in the first, like, 45 of this film. So it seems that, yeah, Charlie finds out that knocking over the casino means he's going to run afoul of his bosses. So he calls it off. He tries to brush it all under the rug and have McCain and son eliminated. Well, takes care of the son, and that basically puts Hank on a dedicated collision course. And pretty much out of spite, he just decides, well, fine, I'm going to knock over this casino anyway, and I don't need anyone's help.
Well, this is the thing what I kind of find fascinating. If there is something really interesting about the film, it's these weird dynamics that are at play between the characters and their sort of the combination of their status and their relationships amongst one another. Because the film, basically, like I said, when we talk about the idea of McCain not being a good father, you might think that somehow this film, you know, is built around eventually some sort of reconciliation between McCain and his son.
I definitely sort of growing thought that was going to be like the thematic through line of this film.
Yep, and about halfway through the film, nope. Basically, McCain pretty makes it pretty clear that he has zero regard for his son and doesn't care about it whatsoever.
And the film itself doesn't seem to really care about Junior too much either, because correct me if I'm wrong, but Junior's parentage is never really explained, is it? Like, well, we know McCain is his father, but there's no mention of why he's only seen him twice, who his mother is, how Junior got involved in the criminal underworld. Like, what, you know, it's, this film plays very close what information it reveals. And again, so a lot of it we can only fill in via inference. But as a result, though, there are moments that I think are supposed to come off as emotional beats, but they really don't. And the fact that, like, there's hard men, there's 1960s hard men, and then there's John Cassavetes. You know, he at least looks the part of a guy who has gone through some really hard years and really just doesn't want to be disturbed. And I mean, like, you can say the same thing about Lee Marvin in Point Break, for instance, or pretty much anyone other than Jason Statham, who's tried to play the Parker character, where, you know, these are not emotional or sensitive men. These are career lowlifes, you know. They're good at what they do, and what they do ain't pretty. So that's why it seems so weird that it sets up this notion that there might be, like, the reclamation of the family. But I think it's also entirely fitting that the film abandons that thread halfway through. And Junior's death, I mean, I think I have in the notes, like, that when he sees his son get stabbed in the back as a result of the raid gone awry, you know, he just gives this look loads his gun, and basically has an expression that's like, well, this is a hassle. And, like, that's all we get out of it.
And, but then the thing about it is, that's kind of the dynamic. I like the fact that it's not this, they don't play it like it's this big emotional moment for McCain. It's like, I guess I better go kill this SOB who just killed my son. Does it. And then he picks up his son's body, throws it in the back of the car. We don't ever see what he does with it. Nobody talks about it.
Yeah, he drives under a bridge. Like, yeah, because watching it, I was so confused. And maybe it's just because of the film's differing versions, it seems that no one can quite track down. It feels like there's a scene missing there. Because his son is alive, but, like, dying. He puts him in the car, and then he drives for a bit, and then he pulls under a bridge, and then we never see the son again. So it...
Well, there could very well have been a scene of just him, like, even him chucking the body into a river. Like, I mean, I could see that that would be the end result here, and maybe that was considered too dark. I don't know.
But in terms of characterization, that would still be fine, because, you know, as we learn, like, McCain isn't really a sympathetic figure. He's not someone that, like, learns a lesson or anything like that. So even having a scene of him disposing of his son's body, however dispassionate he might be, that still tells us something about the man. And instead, we just get this, like, absent scene, and there's no real closure, and we don't really know how to read it. It's just confusing.
It's confusing, but then we get juxtapositions throughout this film, such as his wife, Irene, who literally he meets after his son has gotten him out of prison, gets married to her, like, within 24 hours, and he is far more bothered by her death late in the film than he ever is by what happens to his son. Likewise, as we later discover, he had this whole relationship with some Rosemary, played by Gina Rowlands, John Cassavetes' real-life wife and longtime creative collaborator.
The Bacall to his Bogart.
Yeah. And there's this fascinating dynamic there where basically there's a whole Bonnie and Clyde-like history that those two had, where you kind of get the sense that the reason he married Irene once everything sort of falls into place is he pretty much was afraid, you know, didn't want to face the possibility of rejection by her. At least that's the way it reads to me. The film never makes it terribly clear.
Well, in your notes for the film, you also mentioned this film explores the crucial question of what happens when Bonnie and Clyde get old. And I think that's actually pretty apt.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, basically, there were these love-struck bandits on the run who got arrested by the cops, unlike, you know, the murdered Bonnie and Clyde. And what does how many, you know, like, I think they state that she served 12 years in prison. He was on a life sentence, and she's been paroled. He's gotten his way bought, or he's had his way bought, or he's bribed her, or somebody's bribed for him to get out. Suddenly, they have to sort of meet up after all that time apart, and yeah, you know, credit where credit's due. When Gina Rowlands walks into this movie, you know what? Whatever the failings of the script are for the most part, I buy the dynamic between those two.
Yeah, like, Gina Rowlands is in this film for maybe like 9 minutes of screen time, and they are amazing. Because that dynamic, like, McCain actually comes alive. And moreover, like, Rosemary is such an interesting character because she's, you know, am I wrong to think that the film implies that she's working as a prostitute or a madam of some kind?
I never got that sense.
But, like, she... Well, because she's there with the gentleman she's bringing up to her apartment. She's like, oh, don't worry about it. I'll see you on Tuesday. And, you know, it's just the way they play off of each other. Like, like, this is the only moment where we feel like McCain actually cares about something. Because when you contrast that to him meeting Irene, like, that scene is interesting in that he walks into a casino, you know, he sits down at the bar, Irene's sitting there being bothered by, like, two lounge lizards, and he just sits there and, like, looks at her, and he basically, like, it's almost like he compels her to love him through sheer force of will. And the exact opposite happens with Rosemary, where, like, the moment that they reunite, like, they just full-on embrace each other, and, like, that defense slips. But it begs the question of, I think, as you said, like, why then is he so concerned with Irene? And I think the only way it really does make sense is, as you put it, like, securing her for an emotional safety net.
Well, that's just it. I mean, it makes sense like that. And there does, you do get the sense that maybe he does care something for her. Almost, if anything, it seems like he maybe is recreating what, you know, he and Rosemary, or at least attempting to recreate what he and Rosemary had prior to their prison arrest.
Did Rosemary have a thick Swedish accent?
No, she did not. Unless that was something that was left on the cutting room floor. Who knows? But yeah, and it certainly does help that Britt Eklund is not the best actor on the face of the earth. Certainly not based on her performance here, where she... Although there is something kind of charming about how she just goes along with everything.
Well, like, she's not that dissimilar from a lot of other characters in the film, where most of the characters we follow are passive in one way or another. Even though McCain is like the prime mover of the plot and like the one with the most agency, like by the film's conclusion, we realize that he's kind of just receiving. You know, the same way that like Junior, he walks into the film as a means to an end. He's instrumental in setting up the heist, and then he just is sent to his fate. Kane meets his fate. Irene, she's just there to go along with things. Like, I think that's why Rosemary stands out so much. Not just because, like, Shayna Rollins is pretty great in the limited time that she has, but she's, like, the only person that pushes back and challenges people on things.
Well, she does. And, I mean, her final scene in this film, it plays out. Yeah, it's just, like, amazing. It's just, like, you know, do you mind if I have one last one cigarette before you give me this makeover? Like, that, like, just her delivery of that line is just so killer. It is just,
unfully
again,
intended.
What she... Yeah.
But, yeah, so it's... Yeah, I guess we completely sidebarred our plot description, but if we want to be linear and chronological, yes, so McCain ends up setting up all these elaborate explosives around the Las Vegas, and in the confusion, robs the casino. In the aftermath, Charlie ends up getting killed by, is it Don Frank?
Is it Don Francisco?
Let me double check. Francisco, yeah. Everyone calls him Frank. Who, unbeknownst to Charlie, is having an affair with Charlie's wife, and Charlie's wife tips off Don Francisco that Charlie was in on the heist. So he ends up dead, and then McCain and Irene go on the run. He is seeking safe passage and a way out, so he ends up finding Rosemary for help. But that's short-lived because the mob finds her, and while they're trying to sweat her down, you know, in the apartment, like, they give her the classic mob implied threats, talking about how they're gonna give her a makeover she won't like to look at, and that's when, as you pointed out, she just basically smiles and says, well, mind if I have a cigarette? And then happily and, like, calmly pulls a handgun out and shoots herself in the head.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the last 10 minutes are just trying to get on a boat at a shipping yard. Turns out that the mob enforcers have Irene, and then they tell her to go find McCain. They shoot her in the back. McCain gets upset, and then he gets shot to death as well. And then the bodies are just left there while the mob guys drive off. And that's how this film ends.
And it just occurs to me, there is kind of a way in which you could do an interesting feminist reading of this movie, particularly about the fact that really the only people who have major agency in this film are, you know, Rosemary and Charlie's wife. And in fact, there is something very much about the fact that this is a film in which most of the male characters are posturing in terms of how tough or in control they are. Because one of the things, I love Peter Falk in this movie, because he comes across as a strong-arm gangster early in the film. And the minute things go wrong for him, he crumbles. Absolutely crumbles in this film. And basically, the rest of the movie is him trying desperately to get control of a situation that he's completely lost control of. And I love the fact that this is a film where he goes to his grave completely oblivious to the fact that, you know, his wife's been having an affair behind his back with his boss, more or less, the entire time. And he has no idea about this whatsoever. I mean, there's something utterly fascinating about that to me.
Yeah, I think I would sort of look at it from the opposite side, where I wouldn't say that you can really apply a satisfyingly feminist reading to this text, but I think it does
Okay.
interrogate masculinity in some interesting ways. And again, like the whole arc with Charlie, I mean, there is something there. And again, because especially like Charlie is the first main character that we're introduced to. And like that opening scene where he tries to shake down the casino owner, and he basically does like all the classic mob archetypes of like, nice place. Be a real shame if something happened to it and all that nonsense. But like, yeah,
Yeah.
and then in his private moments, he's desperately trying to figure out a plan how to get a leg up in Vegas, and then when he realizes whose toes he's gonna step on, you're right, he absolutely panics. And he spends the rest of the film having no idea what to do. And even McCain, like, I don't know, there's that sense of like wounded incompleteness. And he gets himself a young trophy wife, like quite literally, but it's never explicitly stated, but it also seems that, well, no, he's also still mourning for his lost love, but he's also too afraid to just go and talk to her. Like he has to set up all this subterfuge to justify it. And by the time that he does that, it's too late. And like even like the one scene with Junior where he's introduced to the other heist men and he pulls his son aside and he's like, you don't need these punks. And he basically is like, hey, come on, stand up, be more like your father and don't rely on these scumbags, which proves to be very poor advice because Junior's dead in about 10 minutes of screen time later. So, but at the same time, though, it's, the Don, who in a criminal family is the literal father, well, he ends up getting out of it unscathed. He still has his mistress. He still is able to contain all the aberrations to the system. Like, he exercises that firm hand of control.
And it's good to, we should point out here that the Don Francesco DeMarco is the character's full name, just for confirmation, is played by Gabriel Frizzetti, who probably most people will know for playing Tracy's father, mob boss father in Your Honor Majesty's Secret Service, aka the greatest Bond movie ever made. So just one needed to toss that on in there. But yeah, no, you're right. It's kind of this interesting thing where there is a way in which this bit kind of fits into the notion of, the mob as American crime, because basically there's a way in which this film operates where the mafia is pretty much presented as they are businessmen. Like they have board meetings where they get together and decide what to do about problem situations
Yeah,
they
like the
have.
first
There's
scene
the
of the film is that mob board meeting. They take a vote and then they make a phone
Yeah.
call and then is it ever explained who or why the guy who gets murdered in that opening sequence is?
No, they never really explain it. I just find it, fascinating that, of all the choices they could do to take him out, they decided to go the extra cruel route of, yeah, we're not just going to kill him, we're going to run him over in front of his children's school, just so that they could witness daddy getting killed. It's like, okay, I mean, I know the mob is harsh, but that one just seems downright petty for them at that
Well, and
point.
I mean, similar to following the heist, where, there's sort of the series of phone calls, there's the communication from disparate locations, you see the heavies go into the secret room where they're running a numbers operation or something like that. There's again, like, this weird dualism of, like, they're tightly organized, almost corporatized, but everything they're doing is so abhorrent to, normative American values. It's almost like Fritz Lang's M in a sense, where technology and like criminality are presented in ways that like it's much closer to like the way that official operations are organized and use technology and communicational systems. Like it's drawing a clear parallel between the way that General Electric does business and the way that La Cosa Nostra does business.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I think there is some interesting you know, implications, if not, you know, really fleshed out ideas about the notion of, you know, maybe business in corporate America, the idea of these entities that are so large that nobody really knows the full pieces that are on the table at any given time. Because, again, this whole film, you know, hinges on the fact that Charlie doesn't know everything, every piece, bit and piece of the organization that he's part of.
Well, he doesn't even know what's going on within his own family organization.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this idea of things being so big, so unwieldy, and, you know, that, you know, it's all powerful, and yet it's also kind of easy to slip through the cracks in some way. It is, there are some interesting ideas that the film doesn't really develop in any meaningful way. I mean, there are some sly nods and ideas, such as the fact that Irene gets, you know, how is she captured by the mob? Well, because the cabbies are in on it, too. You know, which is just one of those little sort of things where, yeah, this is how far their reach goes. That's kind of interesting.
Well, yeah, and, like, the law is basically non-existent. I think the one really telling scene is following the heist on the casino. The Vegas sheriff ends up meeting with the Don, and they're talking about it, and the Don basically reassures him. He's like, don't worry about anything. We're just going to renovate. There's nothing to investigate. There was just a little breakdown. And then by the end of the scene, the sheriff is lighting the cigar for the Don. And, you know, it's like what we see of the law is, it's almost that it's subordinate to criminality. And it's interesting because, like, you know, 1969, this is post-McCarthyism. This is post, I think, a year before Kent State, but, like, right in the middle of the Vietnam War and its escalation. And all of a sudden we see, like, this sort of, not just American, but a worldwide distrust in institutions. And, you know, in this film, like, it doesn't go over the top with presenting institutional corruption, but rather it shows the absence of these institutions, and in their place, all that power has been assumed by the mob.
Yeah, and it's in a way, I just wish this was kind of a better movie than it was, because I think there are ways which they could really push and develop these notions and ideas with the general scenario they have set up into something that would have far more impact. As it is, it's like, we can read this material here, but the film never feels like it fully justifies the intellectual legwork that the audience is having to do to make some sort of meaning out of it.
Now, let me pose two questions to you, though. Because we were talking about the sort of version history of this film, and it seems like there's an extended cut of it that has been lost to the ages. Even the Blue Underground re-release is what appears to be the theatrical cut. So I think maybe part of that could be the result of just trimming it down for an international film audience. Certain beats, like Junior just being gone, or very strange or confusing things that don't get resolved until later, like after the heist, Irene and Hank running on the beach, Irene basically breaks down and says she can't run anymore, and then the immediate next shot is McCain running on his own. And it's only 15 minutes later we realize, oh, no, Irene is still alive. She's in a safe place. Which begs the question of, why did she break down? I think some of that you can chalk up to the fact that this feels like a film that was trimmed down in the editing room and trimmed down pretty heavily. That, or whoever was making it, was just like, yeah, it's totally fine that this film is just a whole bunch of disparate things that don't add up. But the other question is, Dave, 1969, this is pre-Godfather. This is pre a lot of the archetypes of, you know, the criminal family in that later come to dominate its representation in cinema. And I guess my question is part of why this film seems kind of banal at times is because what it's doing are things that we're very familiar with now. But if we were thinking about seeing this film for the first time in 1969, would it be more significant?
I don't know if it necessarily would be. I mean, it's even... While you could see that there are things that, you know, would, are sort of precursors to what we would see with Ford Coppola's adaptation of Mario Puzo's The Godfather and, you know, later film mob-based movies, this really just, so much of this film feels more that it's harkening back to, again, material that we'd seen sort of in the early to mid-60s, such as Point Blank, or done better, you know, in another film from around the same time, Get Carter.
Especially the film's ending reminded me a lot of Get Carter, where there's no catharsis. It just ends and no one feels good about it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I mean, it's the thing about this film is it's not that it's bad or that it's necessarily lacking in ideas. It just doesn't know. It doesn't feel affecting ultimately in the same way that these other more successful films do. And I think that you can, that kind of speaks to why, you know, this is a film which has been, for the most part, forgotten. And even amongst, you know, the kinds of fans and film fans that really sort of dive deep into the minutiae, you don't really hear people talking about Machine Gun McCain. It's not like anybody treats this as, this is one of the lost holy grails that people really need to check out because, oh my god, how did we all ignore this for all this time? Like, you don't get to see the same kind of rabid, passionate fan base around this movie that you do with others. And I think in large part that's because that's not the film what it is. It's, you know, it's a really good sketch for what a better movie could be.
Yeah. Ultimately. And I feel like the film doesn't quite know what it wants to be. And again, that may be the function of its final edit, or at least the version that you and I have seen. But like, it's got John Cassavetes, who's doing John Cassavetes things. It's got Peter Falk, who's pretty good. It's got Gina Rowlands, who's amazing. It's got a score by Ennio Morricone. And, you know, it feels weirdly absent from a lot of stretches of the film, but when it shows up, like, it's forceful. But the end credits, okay, it plays the Ballad of Hank McCain, I think it's called, and it's a lyrical song, and it's been stuck in my head all day, so thanks for that, Dave. But I think if you actually listen to the words of the song, like, it's talking about, you know, the man they called McCain knew that a man who wants to be free just hits his head against a wall. And, like, it's kind of, it feels like a song about the inescapability of fate or the absence of free will. And I'm like, but that's such a weird song to end your film with, because this film really doesn't seem to be about that. Like, you know.
Well, if, not only.
Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, no,
you take it, Dave.
No, I was going to say, you're right. No, the film is not about that at all. Not to mention the fact that this entire song, The Ballad of Hank McCain, he's sung by what sounds like a Tom Jones sound-alike, you know, doing his best quasi-Thunderball, you know, audition tape, which is completely out of place with the rest of the film.
I mean, the music's great, it just makes no sense. And I mean, that's kind of metonymic of the film as a whole, where it's something really cool, it just doesn't fit with everything else around it.
Well, I love it as they're playing it, you know, you've got the person who's going to be driving the getaway boat who's just sort of like, I guess I better go in the back of the car and with these guys and, you know. Yeah, it's just like everybody's like, all right, well, we're going, you know. Stuff happened.
Though that as well, though, because this is the guy that's supposed to be getting McCain and Irene out of the country, and he goes in the back of the car, and it's not totally clear, like, is he being coerced, or was he in on the whole plot all along? Because if it's the second one, that really speaks to your point about, you know, if anything, this film is showing that, like, in capitalist structures, that there's really no means of rebellion or resistance. That the system is too big to rebel against. And that, you know, in the sense of, like, once Charlie puts his plan into motion, it's almost like Harry in Angel Heart, where from the outset, there's nothing that anybody can do except meet their fate and come out on the losing end of it.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess there is, I guess there is the extra twist of the notion that it's the system that enables McCain to be out and complete this plan in the first place. But it's such a, I just don't know. I mean, that's the frustrating thing about this film is, you know, if it's making a grand statement, it's being not obtuse, but it's just not making its points clearly enough that they can be comprehended. And it's not like, it's not a movie that is challenging enough either in its formal characteristics or in its thematics, you know, to demand the audience really, you know, engage and dissect the film in any meaningful way. Because ultimately, it still works reasonably well as a basic genre pick. And, you know, I think for a lot of audiences who would see this film would walk in and think, oh yeah, that was a fine, you know, gangster versus gangster film, and, you know, that we killed an hour and a half, who wants to go get a coffee or, you know, or donut?
Or both. Yeah, like, it's just, I can't help but think about Bonnie and Clyde sort of as a counterpoint, and just, the thing is, like, Bonnie and Clyde, even though, you know, the film ends with them dead as well, like, they're, however misguided they're presented in the film as, there's a sense of, like, counterculture or rebellion or, like, the freedom of resistance through criminality. You know, the sense that they're not playing by anybody's rules, and maybe they're doing it in the worst way possible, but, like, they don't want to be part of that system. Whereas, that's not the same thrust that's given here. I mean, like, if that was the case, then maybe the final, the ballad would make a bit more sense. But instead, like, there's never a point where McCain regrets the path that he's on, but there's never really a point where he expresses that he's locked into it either. He never really explains why he's chosen this, but he's never, you know, explained why he's never had that choice either. Like, so instead of, you know, this beautiful window where people can find their own freedom or find that little slice of happiness before the system encloses again, instead we just see a sad, bitter man be gradually dispossessed and ground down. And, like, even his death, it's not like Cagney in White Heat, where you go out in a blaze of glory and, like, a spree of ultraviolence, you know? It's just, he kills a couple people, and the rest of it is him, like, screaming like a wounded animal in a train yard, and then he gets shot a bunch of times, and that's it.
Well, but that's the thing. I mean, he doesn't even, what ends up happening at the end here is, as we sort of noted earlier, Irene gets shot in the back, and you would assume this would lead to sort of an ultra-violent confrontation between McCain and her killers. That's not what happens. He basically just goes into a rage, starts shooting wildly, and then they gun him down. He doesn't even get a symbolic victory of, you know, saying, I'm taking at least some of these guys down with me. It's just, you know, they shoot her, he has nowhere to go, and they gun him down. And again, in theory, there's actually a way where that could play is kind of impactful, where, you know, all the agency that we think that he believes he has turns out to be null and void, which the film kind of gestures towards all throughout it. The problem is, as it's, you know, established and directed, I don't even think we've mentioned the director.
We have not. It's Giuliano Montaldo.
Yeah, and he, you know, the way he stages it, you know, I guess you could read, you know, the way in which McCain's death is shot is symbolic. It could also just as easily be, I really don't want to shoot a vinyl shootout. Let's just put a camera up on the
screen. Well, we're out of money and the film needs to end.
Yeah.
It's also weird because, like, the ending also, it makes me think of Get Carter. And I mean, but that film has that brutally nihilistic streak running all the way through it. So it feels more fitting in that text, but it also makes me think of the, conclusion to, Pierrot Le Fou. Have you ever seen that one, Dave?
Heard of it, have not
seen it. Jean-Luc Godard. But granted, I mean, very few filmmakers make a film like Jean-Luc Godard does. So, like, there's a similarly, like, weirdly flat ending, but it's almost comically absurd at the same time. And, I mean, again, that sort of fits with the film's tone and so over its overall message. Whereas here, like, for a film called Machine Gun McCain, he doesn't use a machine gun very often. And for a film that's presented as, like, a gritty, hard-boiled, like, crime thriller, it basically peaks at the hour mark where there's the heist, which admittedly is pretty cool, but then the rest of it just feels like an extended denouement. So it's like, what is this film trying to do? But that being said, David, I think I may have hit on something. And it comes back to the idea of Vegas. Because what is the number one truism that you learn if you spend time in a casino?
The house always
wins. The house always wins. And I mean, it's not an accident that the film takes place in Vegas. I mean, not just because, well, for its time, it was heavily mobbed up. And I mean, there is no Las Vegas without the American Mafia. But also, it's just the way that they talk about Vegas and how when McCain first goes back there, how he's talking about how as dingy and awful as it is, he never gets sick of seeing the lights. You know, suckers always roll in on the weekend and they lose everything they have. And he knows this, but he never gets tired of seeing it. And even just like the background conversations, there's that great line while he is planting explosives without anybody noticing. Where a guy says, oh, this casino, I always walk out with my shoes dirty and my pockets cleaned. And it's like everybody in this film accepts that, you know, few people will benefit to this setup and none of them are the people who benefit, but they still go along with it anyway. But again, if that's the point that the film is trying to make, or even, you know, reading Vegas as the city of images, whereas its material reality underneath it is very, very different from what it appears to be. Like, it presents that, but it doesn't do enough to develop that into something. So the result is, it kind of feels like this is a gangster movie the same way that Minecraft is a game, where it gives you a whole bunch of tools, but it's up to you to make something out of it. But I'm like, that's not my job as a viewer to tell you what your film is about.
Well, it's weird because, I mean, it is, because on one hand, I disagree in the sense that, you know, because I do feel that ultimately any meeting that's constructed between the film and its viewer is, you know, the viewer has to do the work to get it into it. And ultimately, you know, any text, you know, what you're going to get out of any text is going to be built upon what the viewer is willing to bring to it and take out of it.
I guess, let me rephrase and just say that the viewer shouldn't be working harder than the director and the screenwriter did. I mean, you're right, because ever since Roland Barthes wrote Death of the Author, meaning is an interplay between the text, the authors, and the spectators. But I feel like this is a case where we can apply a bunch of readings. We can look at this as a feminist slash masculine critical text. We can look at it as, you know, the corporatization of criminality or its expansion into the mainstream. We can look at it as emblematic of casino culture. But I feel like it's a problem for me and it doesn't feel satisfying because I just feel like the effort behind those ideas is not put forth by the filmmakers.
No, and you're not wrong. I do agree with you on that note. I mean, certainly, this is a film that it's either half-baked or it's just as a case of you have a bunch of people with their minds and their hearts are in the right place, but they don't have either the ability to achieve what they're setting out to do or they got lost in the woods in their effort to do so. And that could be even the case that maybe they're trying to do too much. Because I think you could easily make a film that would mainly be focused on Charlie or mainly focused on Rosemary or, you know, mainly focused on McCain himself. And those would be perfectly fine films.
Which, going by the title of the film, you'd think it would be.
Well, and that's just it. I mean, it's, I mean, McCain is a protagonist, and ostensibly he is the person we're following throughout this movie, but it's ultimately, I would say, kind of more about the world he operates in and his relationship to others, but those relationships are ultimately more interesting for the people that he's involved with rather than what he's bringing to it himself. And, you know, that then begs the question, I mean, that can be fine, provided that everybody he's running into along the way has an equally strong personality to play off of him. And we get, I mean, he doesn't really share a scene with Peter Falk, so there's not really a moment where he gets, Cassavetes gets to play off of him for any meaningful length of time. Gina Rowlands, as we've acknowledged, she's in the film for maybe 10 minutes max, which, you know, great, but that still doesn't leave John Cassavetes much to play off of.
Yeah, what do you do with the other 80, you know?
Yeah, he gets to play off of Britt Eklund, and, well, yep, fine. Again, you know, I like her as an actor for the most part, but nobody's going to mistake her for being a top-tier talent by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, it depends what qualities you're looking for.
I guess. I think that's ultimately just what it really comes down to this film. It's like, it's a serviceable genre pick. That's, I mean, on that level, I mean, I don't think you're going to walk away from this movie, you know, having felt that it was a complete waste of an hour and a half of your life. But it's not, you know, if you're looking for a gangster movie, there are better ones to find. If you're looking for heist movies, there are better heist movies to see. You know, there's, if you want to see movies about Las Vegas casinos, go watch Martin Scorsese's Casino. It's a much better use of your time at the end of the day.
Debatable.
All right, fair enough. But the point is, you know, it's, you know, Machine Gun McCain is not at the top of any of these lists. It's just, it's on those lists because it does just enough to get noticed.
Yeah. And it's not a Criterion release. It's a Turner Classic Movies, you know? And I mean, well, like, but that's the frustrating thing about it, because it would be one thing to be like, oh, well, this is just a slept-on garbage movie from way back when that no one remembers, and that's just as well. But, you know, there are those seeds, and there are those little potentials that just get frustrated and squandered. And I mean, you're right. You're sort of left wondering what this film might have been, but you don't have to wonder hard because, like, yeah, I mean, almost everything it's doing, another contemporaneous film does it better. Get Carter is that bleak look at crime and violence. Point Break is a better use of a hard man protagonist. You know, The Godfather is the archetype of the mob as a family business. You know, and I'm trying to think for a viewer recommendation. Is there anything that you would say is a good mob movie that deconstructs things from, like, a gendered perspective?
That's a good question.
Hugh Grant and Mickey Blue Eyes.
I'm going to assume you're joking with that one, because it's been at least a solid 20 years since I last saw that.
All I got to say is that this is the second best movie I've ever seen where John Cassavetes is in love with a woman named Rosemary.
There we go. Dear God. But yeah, no, I mean, you know, I'll have to get back to you on that one with a serious answer, because the only thing that's coming to mind is Jane Austen's Mafia, and that doesn't count by a long shot.
Well, on the plus side, we've established that there are worse gangster films than this one. Yeah, it's just, it's weird, and I think it's just, it, as a result of its production, as a result of whatever happened in its final cut, as a result of it coming out at sort of this turning point where it seems like half of the people making films want to reinvent the wheel, or at least interrogate why it spins the way it does, and the other half just says, nah, let's just make gangster movies. And so this film feels like really feels like an orphan, in a sense.
You're not wrong. I mean, it is just kind of a missed opportunity that, you know, tries a little too hard one way, but not hard enough to make it distinguished, I guess.
Yeah, it's, well, at least we got a good ballad out of it.
That we did, that we did.
I think we've pretty much served out the sentence for this one. What do you think?
Yeah. I think so. I guess maybe our patented hits and pits segment might be worth seeing if anybody has any
patented this week. I guess the paperwork finally cleared.
Yeah, they did.
All right. So for the uninitiated, hits and pits, the smaller things that fall through the cracks. Okay, I can think of a few. Do you have any, David?
I'll let you take lead here.
All right. I think for all the film's problems, I think the heist scene itself, it's not nearly as drawn out as, say, like Bob Le Flambeur or, you know, I'm trying to think. Like, when you think of, this isn't a heist movie, despite its plot, but I think the scene that we see of the initial setup and when the plan goes into motion, it's interesting. It's well shot with the use of like the smoke and the colored filters of the emergency light and the rapid cross-cutting between the fire response, the mob response, the chaos on the casino floor. And in the midst of all of this confusion, we see McCain just driving to the scene like laser focused, knowing exactly what he needs to do and being like so immaculately composed in seeing his plan out. I think it's, that's one of the few moments in the film where the formal and narrative registers are in perfect sync with one another. And I think, yeah, like, I mean, it's not notable the way that the shootout in Heat is notable or things like that, but, you know, I think it's a very well crafted sequence. And again, it's a sign that, like, this film wasn't made by a bunch of complete amateurs. There are those little flashes that, hey, these guys can pull things together when they all agree on what they're doing. And that scene is probably the closest expression of, you know, how this film could have been more effective. What about you, Dave? No. Any hits?
Hits? I'm going to give a particular shout out to Peter Falk's death scene in this movie, because, again, I mean, even though he pretty much disappears with, you know, still about 30 minutes to go in this movie, I love how pitiful his death scene
is.
It's not even a scene, you know, again, he doesn't get a chance to fight back. He doesn't get to do anything. He just gets lined up against a wall along with his, you know, useless flacky, and they are just gunned down with the headlights of a couple cars pinned on them. And that's
it. They blind him with the headlights, so we see him feverishly squinting, and then he's shot to death.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, I mean, it's just so stark and, you know, offhanded and how it's handled that it kind of is one of those sequences or little moments that does pack a little bit of a punch to it in a film that otherwise is, you know, kind of pulling its punches all throughout most of it. So kudos to that. What about you, Andrew? Any others?
I'm just trying to think here. I think our introduction to McCain, you know, say what you will about the weird disappearing narration.
We'll get like, back to that.
Before we see McCain, we see as McCain. Because we're told that, okay, well, if this heist is going to work, we need this one guy. And then there's a series of, like, quick cuts, but it's all POV traveling shots of somebody leaving the prison, getting his stuff back, and signing out. And then it's only once he leaves the prison that we do the reverse shot and we see Cassavetes walking out. I think formally it's interesting. Like, it works. It's put together well. And I think it just feels so tonally different from the rest of the film because, like, we never get any point of view shots thereafter. But I mean, I noticed it when it happened. It made me go, huh, that's kind of cool. So I think it works well for what it is. But again, like, it's a glimpse of, it's a glimpse that makes you think the film is going to be very different than what it ultimately becomes. But again, it's a sign that, you know, there are moments where this film knows what it's doing and it does things well. And, you know, that's probably the earliest indication of that. So I did like that. I just wish that there was a bit more interesting things happening on the aesthetic side.
No, that's fair. That's fair. But yeah, I don't have another hit, so I'm just going to take up the ball from what you've just mentioned here and hit the first of two hits for me. That bloody narration. If there's anything that indicates that this film may have been truncated from a longer cut, it's this, you know, narration that pops up like maybe three times in the course of the film. And it's not like first person narration from, like, you know, McCain's perspective or that. It is this bizarre third person narrator that is nobody, as far as we can tell, in the actual events of the film. Like, it's not like it's somebody who was witness or tangentially connected to make it like a second person narration.
And it's done in the style of like 70s local newscaster.
Yeah, it's just, it's super, super weird and kind of amateur hour. And it feels just sort of tacked on as if they held screenings of the movie and were like, oh, the audience isn't getting it. We need to make things clearer right off the bat. And just like shoved it, things to sort of like, okay, this is what's going on, folks. Trust us, this is going to make sense eventually. I mean, again, to sort of come back to a question you'd asked earlier, you know, imagine seeing this, you know, or when it was first released versus today. Maybe it's just the way in which the sort of disorienting rapid cut approach to things, or not having, you know, establishing shots, is a bit more commonplace, particularly for film fans who, you know, deliberately seek out stuff like that. Maybe it, you know, the film flows better with that kind of background. So it just felt unnecessary. Ultimately.
It really feels unnecessary, because the one moment I can think of it really jutting out, like, it's obtrusive because it's absent from so much of the film. But, like, especially following the heist, you know, we see scenes of McCain and Irene driving, and we see scenes of the mob guys on the phone and going into different offices and talking. And what does the narrator pop up to tell us? While McCain and Irene were on the run, the mob was looking for them all up and down the East Coast. It's like, they have no faith in the visuals of their film? They honestly thought people couldn't put that together?
It's possible. I mean, you know, I'll give them the benefit of a doubt and assume maybe they thought this is just getting shown at a drive-in where people wouldn't be paying attention. But still, if they're not paying attention, it's probably because they have better things to be doing.
Yeah, it makes, like, the theatrical Blade Runner look like David Attenborough.
Yeah. Which is, yeah, damn. Didn't think to go there, but okay. Yeah, narration, huge down mark. Luckily, it's not throughout most of the movie. If only it had been in none of the film. What about you, Andrew? Any other pits as you can see it?
I mean, I think we've outlined the big ones. I think I'll give a special mention to the fact how many characters seem to appear just for a scene and have dialogue where there's really no establishing who they are, why they're significant, how, like, even the spatial relations of the film is odd. Like, because especially after the heist, all of a sudden it cuts to presumably the boss of all bosses, I guess Don Francisco's boss, just in his house, and, like, with the poor audio mixing, it's next to impossible to understand what he's actually even talking about. And we get, like, a 3-minute scene of just this old man on the telephone in front of a window. And it's like, yeah, this film feels like it's so many disparate parts that they tried to glue together. And, I mean, like, the scenes with Cassavetes largely work. The scene with Peter Falk largely works. And again, the scenes with Gina Rowlands are the reason to see this film. But it feels like they succeed in spite of everything else that's around them. But again, that gives further credence to my idea that, yeah, whatever this long-forgotten full director's cut of this film was, I'm hoping that it's just that made sense, because otherwise there's a whole lot of things that make you stop and just go, wait, what? Who is that again? Like, this is a 90-minute film, and it felt far longer because I had to keep rewinding to be like, did I miss something here? Only to realize, no, I didn't. It was just missing from the film.
Yeah, no, I can't disagree with that in any way, shape, or form. I will say there is one, though, Pete, that we haven't mentioned here in this. That is homophobic slurs. Yeah. Really? Was it necessary, McCain? Really? So, I mean, I get it. It's a film from 1969. And unfortunately, the use of the one particular word is probably to be expected.
Is it, though? I'm trying to think of any contemporaneous films. You know, like, there are many ways that you can express the same sentiment.
Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that that's the case. It's just, it's one of these things where you're watching this film, and it's not like it adds anything to this movie. In fact, I'm not entirely sure why, you know, that's the road he chooses to go.
It's like 12-year-olds learning what swear words are for the first time. They run around dropping it because it's so shocking.
Easily could have been deleted, but...
Easily could have been, much like the rest of the film surrounding it. Yeah, it's... and again, I think that just speaks to the fact that, like, this isn't a fun or whimsical film. Like, there's no one to really root for, because all of its characters, like, in its telling, were just given reasons not to like people. And if that's the case, just watch Dawn of Justice again.
With fairness, Andrew, I mean, at least Dawn of Justice is, you know, kind of something that you can warm up to eventually, maybe.
Yeah, at least they don't give narration. And then Batman hits Superman in the face.
Yes, yes, that is certainly not the case. Well, then again, they do start talking about, you know, oh, look, you know, they are evacuating, or they're taking the fight to the completely abandoned part of Gotham.
Yeah, small miracle that.
Motivated within the narrative.
Yeah.
But,
well, I guess it's proof that there are worse films than Machine Gun McCain after all.
Maybe. So, I mean, there are worse films than Machine Gun McCain. That's evident. Whether that one in particular is worse or not, we'll leave it up to you.
So if this film ever gets the Criterion, you'll see the pull quote from Dave Babbitt. There are worse films than Machine Gun McCain.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't sell tickets, I don't know what will. So, yeah.
I'm just happy that Criterion decided I was worth it.
Yeah, that's true. So I guess now that we're officially out of bullets, I guess that begs the question, Dave. Where am I going to be taking us next week? Any idea?
It's not Corky Romano, right?
Thankfully, it is not Corky Romano. Instead, I'm going to press that button that turns our car into the submarine, and we are going to travel by sea to a little place called Summer Isle. For earlier, we were talking about how the young Britt Eklund was rather wooden, but I beg to differ. I think she's a little bit on the wicker side, don't you?
Boo.
I know, that was terrible. So we are going to follow Britt Eklund to watch a film that both David and I are very excited to talk about. We are looking at the 1973 Robin Cook-directed version of The Wicker Man. So it's a chance to talk about horror a bit more. It's a chance for David to talk about his own experiences out in that part of the world, and more importantly, David to constantly sidebar us talking about Christopher Lee.
I will do my best, folks, however, not to try and break out into a Scottish accent for no discernible reason. I make no promises, though.
Well, so I mean, it gives me a chance to practice and find a way to do a better Sean Connery. Apologies to all of our listeners. Listener, James. But yeah, so that's what we'll be looking at next week as a delightful change of pace, and thankfully wash the taste of gunpowder out of our mouths.
Indeed. So until that time, You can find me on Twitter as @24panels, and you can find Andrew as @filmstripper on Twitter if you want to contact us. And again, eventually one day we will have a proper home for the show as well, but please rate and review us in iTunes. It's one of the best ways to help people find the show.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I gotta say, Andrew, is there anything, parting words you would like to say to take us out here?
Well, just remember, dear listener, adventure might scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Unless it's the monotony of prison. Bye, folks! Ha 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 ha